Blog Talk Radio.
It's 3 p.m., and I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. We will be talking to those politicians that are working for you and talking about those politicians that are working against you. Just because they're a Democrat, or just because they're a Republican, and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we are going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to ask them questions. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're going to be discussing education system, the military, science, music, sports, oh, and health care. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are your 26-year-olds still on the family health care plan? Or, as the regressive party says, Obamacare. We will bring you what you need to know, because this is the last word. And everything, from the cities, counties, state, nation, the entire world. So sit down and get a pencil, paper, and take this graduate education experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson.
The weather, of course, when it's in season.
Now, Mars, I need some ideas if I'm going to get your town out of the serious trouble it's in.
River City ain't in any trouble.
We're going to have to create some. Must create a desperate need in your town for a boys' band. So why does everybody keep rubbering into the billiard parlor?
Oh, they just got in a new pool table.
They must have seen a pool table before.
No, just billiards.
That'll do it. You just sit where you are, and remember, if you see that music teacher... Are you Mr. Dunlop?
Yeah? Well, either you're closing your eyes to a situation you do not wish to acknowledge, or you are not aware of the caliber of disaster indicated by the presence of a pool table in your community. Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help me cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to give an ironclad leave to yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? But just as I say it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to score in a bop-line game, I say that any boob can take and shove a ball in a pocket. And I call that sloth the first big step on the road to the depths of degradation. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon, then beer from a bottle. And the next thing you know, your son is playing for money in a pinchback suit. And listening to some big out-of-town Jasper, hearing him tell about horse race gambling. Not a wholesome trotting race, no, but a race where they set down right on the horse. Like to see some stuck-up jockey boy setting on Dan Patch? Make your blood boil, well, I should say. Now, friends, let me tell you what I mean. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pockets in a table. Pockets that mark the difference between a gentleman and a bum, with a capital B, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. And all week long, your River City youth will be frittering away. I say your young men will be frittering. Frittering away there noontime, supper time, chore time too. Get the ball in the pocket. Never mind getting dandelions pulled or the screen door patched or the beefsteak pounded. Never mind pumping any water till your parents are caught with a cistern empty on a Saturday night, and that's trouble. Yes, you got lots and lots of trouble. I'm thinking of the kids in the Knickerbocker, shirt tail young ones, peeking in the pool hall window after school. You got trouble, folks, right here in River City. Trouble with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. Now, I know all you folks are the right kind of parents. I'm going to be perfectly frank. Would you like to know what kind of conversation goes on while they're loafing around that hall? They were trying out Bevo, trying out Cubabs, trying out TaylorMade's like cigarette fiends, and bragging all about how they're going to cover up a telltale breath with scents. And one fine night, they leave the pool hall, heading for the dance at the Armory. Libertine men and scarlet women and ragtime. Shameless music that'll grab your son, your daughter, with the arms of a jungle animal instinct, masteria. Friends, the idle brain is the devil's playground. Trouble!
Oh, yes,
right here in River City.
Right
with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool.
We
surely got trouble. Right here in River City.
Right,
gotta figure out a way to keep the young ones moral after school. Mothers of River City, heed that warning before it's too late. Watch for the telltale signs of corruption. The minute your son leaves the house, does he rebuckle his knickerbockers below the knee?
No.
Is there a nicotine stain on his index finger? A dime novel hidden in the corn crib? Is he starting to memorize jokes from Cap'n Billy's whiz-bang? Are certain words creeping into his conversation? Words like swell. Aha! And so's your old man. But if so, my friends, you got trouble. Right here in River City. With a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool. We've surely got trouble. Right here in River City. Remember the Maine, Plymouth Rock, and the Golden Rule. Oh, we got trouble. We're in terrible, terrible trouble. That game with the 16-numbered balls is the devil's tool.
Devil's
tool. Oh, yes, we got trouble, trouble, trouble.
Oh, yes, we got trouble.
We'll see.
We'll
rhyme it with P.
That
rhymes with P. Thanks
for pool.
Remember, my friends, listen to me because I passed this way but once.
All right, that's right, Santa Pool. This is Friday, August 26, 2022. I'm Michael Lawson, and this is The Last Word. And you heard about you watching your kids going out, and they buckle their pants below the knee. Okay, we got trouble in River City. That's right. Well, River City had the pool hall, the pool game coming into their community. What do we have? We had Donald J. Trump coming into our country. He was already here, but he was hidden. He was hidden down in the crevices. Someone opened up those crevices, and he made a wide, wide opening and brought all his shenanigans and all his creatures with him and all his outrageous, outrageous criminal element with him. Now he's trying to say, hey, don't look at what you see. Just listen to what I say because your eyes are deceiving you. Yes, I had 184 documents in those 15 boxes. But you see, there's 184 documents, but how many pages were in? They're saying it's about 1,000 pages. This time, we're not talking about what happened last time, 4 months ago when he took the 15 boxes out. And his lawyer said, oh, that's all we have. And they signed them. You know, you sign it, you are part of the crime, part of the cover-up. Now we understand that they have pictures of him, film of him going through the boxes. And you see, he's trying to say, well, I didn't know these, this is what he's going to say, his lawyers, I didn't know these documents were in those boxes. Because I had all the love letters from Kim Jong-un with it and from the French president in the box. I just threw everything in the box and brought it with me. But here's the problem. You shouldn't have had them in the first place. He still has not told us why he had those top secret and confidential papers with him. If he had them in the White House, they don't go to the residence when he leaves. They go back down to the skiff so he can get it tomorrow or the next day. But he never got to the office till 12 o'clock. He missed all the debriefings. So he just said, well, you know, I never heard the debriefings. I just, I wanted to read them when I could. He never read because he can't read. So what is the reason why he had these documents in the first place? And he says, they're mine. They're not his. They don't belong to him. They don't have his name on it. Does president? No, it doesn't even say president. This is top secret, confidential. That's what it says. So, you know, let's hear what Michael Cohen said about this.
And you're listening to the Mea Culpa podcast.
The more that they attack President Donald Trump, the more it makes me want to support him.
Why is it that people stay loyal to him when they watch their entire lives get destroyed, get thrown right down the dumpster while Donald Trump is sitting stuffing his face at Mar-a-Lago? It makes absolutely no sense. It took me going to prison to wake up and to extricate myself from the cult of Donald Trump.
I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
Just because Trump, his kids, and his business are all under investigation, and that Rudy is sweating it out in Fulton County Courthouse, and Miss Lindsay is fighting back a subpoena, and just because indictments are about to be passed out like candy, it doesn't mean that democracy is safe. Just because we know these things are happening doesn't mean that they're going to stop or that justice will be served, because the jury is still out on all of it. Except, of course, for Alan Weisselberg. He's going down.
Donald Trump's longest-serving employee, Alan Weisselberg, walked into a New York courtroom today and pleaded guilty again and again and again to committing fraud together with the Trump Corporation. The judge literally used the phrase, together with the Trump Corporation, over and over today while reading the charges against Alan Weisselberg.
Weisselberg, one of the Trump's most loyal lieutenants and someone I worked with for over a decade, pled guilty to numerous crimes in a New York courtroom Thursday. All crimes, of course, having something to do with the Trump Organization. But nevertheless, the idiot took the rap. Not that the Trump Organization is off the hook. They will face charges of their own in October. But for now, Weisselberg has refused to turn on his old boss despite years of pressure from the Manhattan District Attorney. Weisselberg has been charged with 15 felonies, but because of a plea deal, he won't do 15 years in jail, just 100 short days.
The idea that Alan Weisselberg is not cooperating is true only in the narrowest sense. He now has to go to trial with this sort of sword hanging over his head that if he is found to be lying, he can get 15 years in prison. So he is over the cold now, and there might as well be a cooperation agreement in place, because he is now going to, I think, be a material witness against the Trump Organization.
Under the plea deal, Mr. Weisselberg must pay nearly $2 million in taxes, penalties, and interest after accepting lavish off-the-books perks from Mr. Trump and the company, including leased Mercedes-Benzes, an apartment on Manhattan's Upper West Side, and private school tuition for his grandchildren. He's also got to testify against the Trump Organization in October, but as outlined in the terms of this deal, he will not have to testify directly against the former president. He simply refused to do it.
Alan Weisselberg, he has to testify at the Trump Organization's upcoming trial in October. That's a part of his plea deal. But based upon what you said before the House Oversight Committee, isn't it inevitable that he's going to implicate Donald Trump directly?
So it seems that way. You know, I've received, after the Weisselberg plea, I've received no less than maybe 50 phone calls from journalists all over the world. It's not even just in this country. And many of them turn around and say, well, I've heard that the questions that they're going to be asking Weisselberg are merely about the apartments, the cars, the perks that were given, and not about anything else. That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, that would probably be about the worst move that Alvin Bragg made, including dropping the case against Trump in the first place. Simply because here's what happens. The guy's getting 5 months for 15 counts over God knows how many years. It's close to $2 million. It was a scheme within which to defraud. We know that his sons were also being looked at, so clearly they must now get a pass. On top of that, he is required to testify. Why would you limit the extent of the testimony that prosecutors want to ask and only ask questions about, you know, the perks that were given to him, which is what's now going to put Alan Weisselberg in Rikers Island for at least a minimum of 100 days. According to the New York Times, Mr. Weisselberg insisted that Mr. Trump had done nothing wrong and that he would rather go to jail than fabricate a story about him. But he did come up with something, that Mr. Trump would occasionally draw a circle around the valuation of an asset on his annual financial statement, adding a question mark beside the number. But Mr. Trump, he said, did not order anyone to inflate the numbers.
To your knowledge, did the president or his company ever inflate assets or revenues?
Yes.
And was that done with the president's knowledge or direction?
Everything was done with the knowledge and at the direction of Mr. Trump. Must have been a difficult decision for Weisselberg. He's 75 years old, and after many months of wrangling with the court, he ended up hurting himself and the Trump Organization. But once again, Trump was spared.
On Thursday, the federal judge who approved the FBI search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago home almost 2 weeks ago found the Justice Department had not met the high threshold for showing that the entire affidavit should remain sealed. But he did order the immediate release of these other procedural records that provided some insight into the possible crimes that led to the Mar-a-Lago search.
Thursday, in another courtroom in Fulton County, Georgia, in front of a special grand jury, Fannie Willis finally had her way with Rudy Giuliani. We don't know whether or not he took the fifth or how many times, but for the first time in months, Rudy fucking colluding Giuliani looked sober as a judge. Plus, he kept his mouth relatively shut when dealing with the press. It may have finally dawned on him that his reputation has been totally decimated. No longer America's mayor. He'll go down as just another fucking Trump stooge.
Class president, prosecutor, mayor of New York City, Time Person of the Year. These are just some of the hats worn by Rudy Giuliani before we knew him as President Trump's right-hand man. So how did he go from this?
He's the mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani.
Do this.
And I'd love to know what they've got on Lindsey Graham. But whatever it is, it's not helping him weasel out of having to testify in the same 2020 election fraud case that's got Rudy going down. His lawyers made arguments to keep Lindsey out of court that one judge called fucking absurd and ordered him to appear before the special grand jury next Tuesday. The judge wrote that the public interest would not be served by granting a stay or delaying Mr. Graham's testimony.
Trump and I, we've had a hell of a journey. I hate it being this way. Oh, my God, I hate it. From my point of view, he's been a consequential president. But today, first thing you'll see, all I can say is count me out. Enough is enough.
Two other Trump team lawyers who unsuccessfully fought their subpoenas, Jenna Ellis and John Eastman, are scheduled to appear before the grand jury before the end of the month.
But wait, there's more. The grand jury might also hear from sitting Republican Governor Brian Kemp.
Kemp's still trying to quash his subpoena to testify before the grand jury, and he's accusing prosecutors of being politically motivated since he's running for re-election. But amid all of this news about witnesses who have testified or might soon testify in Georgia, it's important that we don't forget about the star witness in this entire case, the tape.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
And the ultimate Florida man, Ron DeSantis, lost bigly in a St. Petersburg courtroom Thursday when he tried and failed to get his Stop Woke Act passed. Stop Woke, which just sounds fucking stupid, was a lame attempt to kill critical race theory with a law that would have restricted race-based conversation and analysis in businesses and in education.
A judge is blocking part of a new Florida state education law, the Stop Woke Act, banning education in classrooms or workplaces of concepts like inherent racism or discussions that make people feel guilty over their race. The judge says it violates the First Amendment. He referenced Netflix's hit show Stranger Things, saying, quote, "Recently, Florida has seemed like a First Amendment upside down." The judge is preventing the state from enforcing the employee training provisions. Back in April, the governor said the law would fight indoctrination and concepts like critical race theory.
Well, what we will not do is let people distort history to try to serve their current ideological goals. Which all translates to Ron ain't woke and some smart judge decided his idiotic law is unconstitutional. Three more lawsuits against the Stop Woke Act are pending. One of those lawsuits aptly states, the Stop Woke Act aims to forward the government's preferred narrative of history and society and to render illegal speech that challenges that narrative. All I can say is, stop the Stop Woke Act. Seriously. You think about what MLK stood for. He said he didn't want people judged on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. You listen to some of these people nowadays, they don't talk about that. Lastly, when the Supreme Court resumes later this year, fuck knows what they'll attempt to take from us next.
And how did 9 unelected folks end up with our fates in their very old hands?
Abortion battle rages all over the country in the wake of the last session, but recent analysis of the court by a Stanford law professor found that inconsistencies in the high court's application of the law is staggering.
Now, believe it or not, the court was intended to be an apolitical body, interpreting the law through the frame of the Constitution and not any partisan set of beliefs. Seriously, that's not a bit. That's really what it was supposed to be.
Is the high court for or against states' rights? Well, in the case of California, for instance, where mask mandates were in place during the pandemic, the court carved out special protections for churches. Of course, making it impossible for state officials to curb the spread of the virus the moment unmasked worshippers filed into the pews.
Well, isn't that fair, Sean?
Churches, like businesses the world over, could just have easily met on Zoom, but the radical right-wing arm of the court can't help but show its preference for Christian-style religion and its disdain for anything that Fox News might find reprehensible and report on negatively. Like masks, carve-outs based on preference and not law, withdraws from states the power they have long held to manage their own health and safety, public education, and the design of their own governments.
They can't get mad because we're just following in a long and hallowed conservative tradition called states' rights.
And then the court turned around and expanded states' power on the issue of abortion, knowing that they had allies they could depend on in red states to carry their water and pass their laws.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a lower court's judgment against an Indiana law requiring parents be notified when a minor gets an abortion without parent permission.
The court is also accused of limiting the power of lower courts. insulating federal immigration officers from charges of misconduct, functionally handing agents of U.S. Customs and Border Patrol, the nation's largest federal law enforcement agency, a get-out-of-court-free card, and making it harder for immigrants to challenge the decisions of immigration judges, even when a judgment is incorrect.
If Justice Thomas really wants to deal with bullying in America, or this problem of people supposedly unwilling to accept outcomes that they don't like, I've got some advice for Justice Thomas. Start in your own home. Have a conversation with Jeannie Thomas. She refused to accept the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election. Why? Because she didn't like the outcome. And so instead, she tried to steal the election, overthrow the United States government, and install a tyrant. That's bullying. That's being unwilling to accept an outcome because you don't like the results, because the former twice impeached so-called president of the United States of America lost legitimately to Joe Biden. How did she respond? Instead, she said the Bidens should face a military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay on trumped-up charges of sedition. You've got to be kidding me.
This study concludes that what the court is after is power, and it doesn't care what laws it needs to bend or break to get it. A growing chorus of legal luminaries are calling radical fixes to rein in the power of the court, including changes to the number and tenure of justices. This rhetoric is refreshing stuff from the Legal Academy, whose members tend to reinforce the legitimacy of the court and the legal system it upholds. But the court has turned itself into a political institution, and the justices' power grab has made it difficult to trust their motives. That ship has sailed, said the author of the study, and good fucking riddance.
When tens of millions of women vote this year, they won't be alone. Millions and millions of men will be taking up the fight alongside them to restore the right to choose and the broader right to privacy in this nation, which they denied existed. And the challenge from the court to the American women and men, this is a nation. The challenge is, go out and vote. Well, for God's sake, there's an election in November. Vote, 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 vote.
Vote, 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 vote. That's what you have to do. Vote, 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 vote. This is what we have to do. Why are we even talking about this nonsensical nonsense that this man has put us in a position? Just like in the Music Man. Pool room. Nobody ever seen a pool room? No, there's billions. Well, that's the devil's workshop. We knew that when he came riding down the escalator. Did you know, and I did not know this, I heard this the other day, that, remember there was a movie called,
Al Pacino. Al Pacino's film biography. Al Pacino played in a movie where he was the devil. Well, if I can get this back here. Al Pacino. I'm looking it up right now because I don't want to make mistakes on this. Yeah, Al Pacino is one of my favorite actors. And Al Pacino. Al Pacino. Al Pacino. Let's see what I can get with this. How come I can't get anything with this? Let's see. Al Pacino. That's how I spelled it. All right, now let's see here. He played in a movie, and I want to get this right because I thought it should have been a Academy Award winning film, but it was so great. The Devil's Advocate. Did you know, ladies and gentlemen, that that film, The Devil's Advocate, was filmed at in Manhattan Live at his office where he lived and he did all his nonsense as the devil? Was that Trump Tower? Before it was Trump Tower. So Donald Trump is actually using the same building where Al Pacino played the devil's advocate and was the devil. That is very coincidental. As the Kingfish used to say in the Amos and Andy, it's too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence. I could not believe that. Al Pacino played the devil, and he played the devil, what's his name? Okay. It made $153 million. That's way back in 1997. What did he play? What was his name? He was a very, very adept lawyer. And he had all these women working for him. Keanu Reeves was a young guy, just got married. And he's offered this major job in a New York City firm with a high-end boss, the biggest opportunist of his, biggest opportunity in his world to take this job. And I tell you, unbelievable. They had, they had this guy, his name was John Milton. That was his name. And that was Al Pacino's, the devil's name in that movie. And what happens is that he didn't know how ruthless he was, Keanu Reeves. He's a young lawyer. And he's from Florida. So, you know, he don't know about a big city, really, even Florida. You don't know nothing about the big city, even though you live in the major city in Florida. It's still nothing. And he never lost the case. This was got in his head. He never lost the case. And so he was recruited by this major law firm, Al Pacino. He said, New York City is like Babylon. You can't get any bigger than this if you work here. He accepts the offer with this money that's just outrageous. But his wife is the thing now. His wife started feeling sort of something was wrong. Something was not right. And what happens is that his name is Kevin Lomax. And what happens is and his mother disagrees with him coming to New York City. She's, I once said about Babylon, she compares New York City to Babylon. But he accepts the offer anyway because the money was so fabulous. But soon his wife starts feeling homesick and seeing devilish apparitions around. However, and that's how he gets his wife to accept it. They're giving her all these, his wife, all these different things that she can do and people to see. And then Kevin starts getting a sinking feeling. He starts getting a sinking feeling in all the new cases and pay this and less attention to his wife. He starts paying less attention to his wife. His boss, It is meant that John Milton seems to always know how to overcome every problem, and that just freaks out Keanu Reeves or Kevin. And the thing is, he jumps at this large firm, and of course his wife's name is Marianne, and she starts feeling homesick, but it's not really homesick. It's just that the people that Milton is introducing her to just don't quite have that nice feeling to them. Everything seems to be too insane. His wife understood everything after a while, but he was so locked up in his work. He says, I don't lose cases. I win cases. That's how you're supposed to do. But anyway, he got to a place where after getting all these things, and she wanted to have a baby, which she could have. And the thing is that when she starts losing her grip on reality, so it's in... Keanu Reeves says is about to find out, who finds out that his true heritage and the grand scheme John Milton is running from his penthouse apartment, Trump Tower. And, that's what it's about. He finds out in the end that supposedly he's leaving. And one of the people in the office says, okay, you make sure you keep in touch with me. He's, oh, I will. And as Keanu Reeves and his wife are leaving, going down the stairs, the young guy he was talking to, morphs back into Al Pacino's face, or the devil's face, and starts smiling. So he never loses. And he says these things are so treacherous. But here's someone the devil tried to get a hold of by offering him everything. But he virtually said no. In the film Devil's Advocate, that's just what happened in the film Devil's Advocate. In real life, with Donald J. Trump, he was born into it. Because his father was the head of the KKK in New York City. His father turned traitor on his own country, Nazi Germany, because they wanted him to give money to German war plans in World War I, and he didn't want to do it. So he left Germany to come back to the United States. And in New York City, he was the head of, and I think it was like 1915, 1917, maybe it was a little sooner than that. He became the head of the KKK in New York City. And when they rushed New York City, all the policemen got beat up and shot. They did not turn him in. Everybody else turned themselves in, but he wouldn't turn in his grandfather. So he got away. So his family has always gotten away with it. None of his family members, men that is, has ever been actually persecuted. J. Trump will be the first one that is persecuted, because I believe he's definitely going to be a major problem in this country. And as Lawrence O'Donnell said the other day, here's what Lawrence said. Listen,
is now a full year and a half into the worst life ever lived by a former president of the United States. Donald Trump, his life is a misery from the moment he wakes up too early in the morning through those dark hours in the middle of the night when he's struggling against the insomnia to find some peace. Peace that never comes. Pure misery. That is his life. Prior to Donald Trump, the worst post-presidential life ever lived was Richard Nixon's 20 years after being forced to resign the presidency in disgrace because of the crimes he committed in office, for which he was assuredly going to be impeached if he stayed in office, and convicted in the Senate and removed from office. But 1 month into Richard Nixon's painful post-presidency, his successor, Gerald Ford, relieved him of the worst pain by granting him a full pardon for any crimes Richard Nixon committed during his presidency. Donald Trump does not have the comfort of a pardon to soften the agony of his days and nights. And so Donald Trump's life now is much, much worse than the 20 years Richard Nixon spent in mere disgrace after the presidency. I say mere disgrace because Donald Trump spends every day and every night under disgrace and multiple threats of indictment, of federal and state indictments, possible of criminal convictions eventually, both federal and state, for possible crimes committed while he was president and possible crimes committed after his presidency, including crimes that he might actually be committing tonight if he is still illegally in possession of any of the government documents, including classified documents, that he was supposed to return to the National Archives. Every day of Donald Trump's life now is worse than the day before, and tomorrow is going to be much, much worse than today, because tomorrow we are going to see significant portions of an FBI affidavit that the Justice Department will release following an order to do so from a federal judge today who approved the Justice Department's redactions in that affidavit to protect the identity of witnesses and the possible investigative techniques being used in an ongoing criminal investigation of Donald Trump. U.S. Magistrate Judge Bruce Reinhart, who authorized the search warrant of Donald Trump's Florida home, has ordered federal prosecutors to make the redacted version of the affidavit used to support the search warrant public on or before noontime tomorrow. Could be anytime tomorrow morning. That redacted affidavit that supported the search warrant, while blocking witnesses' names and FBI agents' names, is going to reveal substantial evidence against Donald Trump. Donald Trump said he was an insomniac long before he reached the presidency. How do you think Donald Trump is going to sleep tonight? Tonight, Donald Trump knows that even the redacted version of the FBI affidavit released tomorrow is going to make tomorrow the very worst day of his life so far, only to be followed by even worse days, including possible days in court, in federal court, or in Georgia state court as a criminal defendant Donald Trump. Donald Trump knows what's coming better than any of us do, because Donald Trump knows what he did. Donald Trump knows what he did when he was trying to overturn the presidential election in Georgia and other states. Donald Trump knows what he did leading up to and during the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Donald Trump knows what he did when he decided to steal government documents and bring them home. Donald Trump knows what he decided, that he decided to illegally possess those documents for a year and a half. Donald Trump knows who made the decision to do that. He did. Donald Trump also knows that he now has terrible lawyers defending him. Really, in effect, no one defending him now. Donald Trump knows, as of today, his last White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, is being subpoenaed to testify about him to District Attorney Fawnie Willis's grand jury in Atlanta. Notice that Donald Trump is not making any public comments now, warning Mark Meadows and his former election lawyer, Sidney Powell, who has also been subpoenaed to that same grand jury in Georgia. No warnings from Donald Trump about flipping. Notice that Donald Trump He's not warning any of these witnesses not to flip, as he publicly did when he was president, to use that word flip. As president of the United States, Donald Trump publicly warned Paul Manafort not to flip. That was the word he used publicly, the gangster word for telling the truth. He did the same thing with Roger Stone. He did the same thing with Michael Flynn. Donald Trump did that while he was president of the United States because he knew he had an attorney general who would protect him against charges of obstruction of justice. Tonight, Donald Trump is under investigation by Attorney General Merrick Garland, specifically for obstruction of justice, among other things. That is how Donald Trump's life has changed. That is how it has become pure misery. And tonight, Donald Trump, living in fear of a real attorney general for the first time in his life, does not dare to play the public game of witness intimidation and obstruction of justice that he played and was allowed to play when he was president of the United States. Donald Trump knows what it feels like to have the full protection of the presidency. Donald Trump knows what it feels like to have the full protection of an attorney general, William Barr, who believed the old Nixon lie that if a president does it, it's not a crime. When you've had that kind of protection, imagine what it's like to have none. Tonight, Donald Trump has no legal protection against what he did. And Donald Trump knows what he did. And that's why no president in history has ever lived the agony that Donald Trump is living tonight. Donald Trump is asking himself, will I be indicted? Donald Trump is asking himself, how many times will I be indicted? It has been 17 days since the FBI executed a search warrant at Donald Trump's home, and Donald Trump has not offered one word of defense or explanation about what was in his home. Not one word. Donald Trump has been terrified into abject silence about the evidence because he knows what the evidence is. Donald Trump began his day today on his social media site at 8:50 a.m. with a series of short bursts of anger that would be called tweets if he was still allowed on Twitter, and they proved how desperate and cornered Donald Trump's mind is now. Clearly, his mind was on the agony of the criminal investigations of his activities, primarily involving the FBI search of his home. But in the first burst of rage, he didn't talk about that. Instead, he just mentioned Joe and Hunter Biden and the laptop from hell. Nothing about the evidence against Donald Trump. In the second one, Donald Trump said Joe Biden said he knew nothing about the break-in of Mar-a-Lago or the greatest political attack in the history of the U.S. Does anybody really believe this? Now, the answer to that question is yes, most people believe Joe Biden. And the documentation in the case now shows that President Biden specifically refused any involvement in the decision about what to do about government documents kept at Donald Trump's home after the Trump presidency. Back when Donald Trump was protected by the presidency and protected by the Attorney General, Donald Trump wouldn't have asked the question, does anyone believe Joe Biden? He would have called Joe Biden a liar. He would have called Merrick Garland a liar by name and attacked Merrick Garland by name personally, but Donald Trump is afraid to do that now. So now it's just a question, does anyone believe that? Donald Trump is living an unprotected life, and that terrifies him. A few minutes after those statements on his social media thing, he had this burst saying, I have done absolutely nothing wrong. It cannot be the presidential records act cannot be circumvented for me or any other president. He was saying, they illegally raided my home and took things that should not have been taken. They even broke into my safe, an unthinkable act. Donald Trump does not really believe that when the FBI searches a home, there is some part of the home that they must not search, like, say, a safe, which I promise you, every time the FBI raids a home or enters a home and finds a safe, that's the first thing they go in. Donald Trump's just pretending that the search of his safe was unthinkable. 1 minute later, Donald Trump blurted out the statement, Presidential Records Act, exclamation point. That was it. Presumably as if that is a defense instead of the reason that Donald Trump's actions are illegal. We know Donald Trump violated the law as stated in the Presidential Records Act. We don't yet know if he will be prosecuted for that violation. 7 minutes later, Donald Trump made his last statement of the day about any of this, saying the Justice Department and the FBI are leaking at levels never seen before, and I did nothing wrong. Both of those things are not true. There have been no leaks at all from the Justice Department as far as we know, and we absolutely know that Donald Trump did many things wrong with those documents that he was illegally possessing at his home. I read you what Donald Trump had to say today simply to plumb the depths of his abject desperation and now no doubt near madness. As we stand poised at the threshold of reading more about criminal conduct by Donald Trump in the FBI affidavit that will be released before noontime tomorrow, the affidavit that convinced a federal judge that a search warrant of Donald Trump's home would probably reveal evidence of crimes, crimes including the mishandling of government documents and the crime of obstruction of justice. Donald Trump knows what he did, but even Donald Trump doesn't know what is in the FBI affidavit. He won't get it 1 second before we do. If Donald Trump has the strength to read it tomorrow, he will be reading it at the same time we read it. Because the special treatment of Donald Trump is all over. And now for Donald Trump, there is nothing but misery followed by misery.
I'm sorry, I had my microphone off. Well, I'll have to repeat everything I said. I don't know, big dummy. Dummy. Anyway, here's the thing. They kept talking about what this guy wants to do. He's never answered the specific question. Why the hell does he have this paperwork with him? Why does he have it? All right, it's a mistake. I had the paperwork on my desk. I threw it all in the box. No, he didn't do that. Maybe he did do that. That's not the way you're supposed to do that. You're supposed to take the paperwork. When you leave an office, there is a group of people that packs your stuff in the White House, the residency, and there's a different group of people that packs your stuff in the White House. Because the stuff in the White House is the president's stuff that has to be saved to the archives. And none of that stuff is yours unless someone gave you a pen that's there. That's all that, because that's, I believe, the only thing you can get. Small. You cannot accept gifts, money, or anything as president of the United States. How many people didn't know that? You can't, you might not be even allowed to accept a pen unless it's, you know, if it's got your name on it instead of the 45th president of the United States. I don't know. I once did, but I don't know now. I can look that up. But anyway, let's look this up right now. How much? Let's see. Let's see what that is. How much can a president of the United States accept as a gift? Foreign heads of state aside, the president is generally permitted to accept personal gifts from the American public. But he must disclose the gift in a financial disclosure report when it exceeds $350, meant to show transparency. That's why this is. So he can accept the gift, but it can't be over $350. So he can accept the pen. This is a gold, solid gold, bit of gold ink coming out of it. And as an employee may not give or select a contribution for a gift to an official supervisor, superior, and may not accept a gift from an employee receiving less pay if the employee is a subordinate. Now, the federal rules, there are rules for this. Federal government policy, rules on gifts in the federal government. Rules on gifts in the federal government. Government ethical rules restrict giving and accepting gifts among employees and from outside interests. Policies on the exchange of gifts among employees as well as on the acceptance of gifts or hospitality from other sources are set by the government. Wide rules found in the Code of Federal Regulations 5 CFR 2635, 201-205, and 301-304. And if you have any questions about that, gratuity, here's the thing. You know who's in Italy right now on a ship that looks like the MS Sea Cruise? That bald-headed ex-governor. That racist. He's down there right now, and he's complaining about what Biden wanted to do, about giving him $10,000, cutting $10,000 in the course for schooling. Biden wants to, and he wants to pass a $10,000 cut. He's already said a federal law, which he controls, he said that I am now going to cut the federal spending for schooling. If you have $10,000 or less, it's going to be over with. It's a gift. That's what he said recently. And this clown, the governor, let's see here. Ex-governor of California. He used to be, nope, that's not it. Ex-governor of Florida. Rick something or other. Rick Scott. Rick Scott is complaining while he's on a yacht. Now, he has to report that gift. Let's see if he does. He's got to report how long he stayed there, what was given him. You got to figure it's $5,000 or more. The thing is that these people don't do this. These people don't, these senators congressmen don't do that. They should, but they don't. Now, here's a problem that Trump needs. And I don't know if you heard this, but let's listen to this. Is Ari Melba.
Now to our special report. A former president's struggle to get just about any criminal defense attorneys while he's facing basically the most escalating simultaneous criminal probes of his long litigious life. The new headline this week is familiar. Everyone at law firms saying no to Trump's bids to get seasoned lawyers. It's familiar because you may recall it's a problem Trump also faced, and this was documented during the Mueller probe. Now, the reporting states the reasons stem from, one, Trump is a person, and two, Trump is a deadbeat. His style and refusal to cooperate or take advice makes him nearly impossible to represent, say sources. One observer diplomatically noted it would be unclear if new lawyers would ever get paid. Yes, it would be unclear. Or there's a long line of litigation and complaints about him not paying bills. So Trump has been in similar spots before, and he has found lawyers, and he has evaded other cases. So let's be clear. You might hear this and say, okay, Ari, but we've heard about this before, and then he still got away. But I want to be clear with you, only following the facts as we can find them, Donald Trump is in a measurably worse and more desperate legal condition now. For example, before, he'd never been subject to a criminal search of his home. That's a first this month. He'd never pled the Fifth Amendment until last week. He has a federal criminal probe eyeing his failed coup, which is a set of government-related problems with people cooperating when he's out of government, so different than the Mueller probe. And then just today, as reported, the top finance officer of his company pleading guilty. The whole firm awaits that October trial. And one of Trump's recent lawyers, who's not available to represent him anymore, is because of his legal problems. Rudy Giuliani, busy with the criminal probe in Georgia, where he has been formally targeted for indictment, just testified 6 hours yesterday. And that's a trend with Trump's lawyers. They often find themselves in need of other lawyers. And that's the third reason that sometimes it can be hard for him to find lawyers, because the new lawyers look at this kind of case, understand not only could it be expensive when they don't get paid, but it could be disastrous if they lose their law license, like Roy Cohn, who was disbarred, or Michael Cohen, who was convicted, or the recently searched coup lawyer, John Eastman. Now, Trump's lawyer representing specifically the Florida matter, that search, is already linked to the elector fraud plot, which means she could have Giuliani-type problems, and she left television to work for Trump, but then likened the situation, well, back to the silver screen. Why wouldn't you just release that yourselves?
Well, this is part of the discussion with the Department of Justice. Of course, we're trying to do everything in accordance with the law and
There's absolutely nothing preventing you guys from releasing it, though.
Other than decorum.
That's one relatively new lawyer in Florida where, as we reported, there are signs that the search was more about recovering evidence than preparing charges, meaning that is not Donald Trump's worst problem. Most people would be very concerned to have their home searched under a criminal warrant in any situation, but for him, Florida's lesser. So what's more? Well, as I'm telling you, it's a different story in Georgia where the DA has targeted over a dozen people for indictment for alleged crimes that were to benefit Trump, meaning not just random crimes or people he knows, but crimes for his political benefit, for his attempted coup. And it's linked to his own illicit demands, which were caught on tape.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
That is very bad. That is now criminal evidence. That is on tape. If you follow this stuff sometimes and you say, gosh, it seems like Trump did so much all over the place, especially around trying to overthrow the election, that's public evidence. That's something people can decide whether it disqualifies him for office or not in your own mind and vote. But our legal system, as I've told you, is much more precise. So if he does one thing over here in Wisconsin and another in Georgia, those are two different state probes when dealing with state law. Georgia is the place that's the worst for Trump. Georgia is the place where you have that tape. Georgia is the place where you have others already marked for targeted indictment. Now, having said that, nobody can predict what DAs or grand juries will do. But the evidence matters, so you have more damning evidence in Georgia than any other state. So his problem is most acute there. And let me tell you something. Donald Trump seems to know that. Because while I just showed you the reporting about how he's juggling this search for lawyers in more than one case all over the country and in his home state of Florida and recruiting people off TV or off personal relationships, in Georgia it's a little different, which is our special report. New information, he has now turned to a seasoned criminal defense trial lawyer who has actually clashed with this same DA in Atlanta, who has won some uphill criminal cases, who is part of a small but experienced criminal defense firm. It's the Findling Law Firm in Georgia, and it's headed by the former president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We're talking about real credentials here. The New York Times just broke the news that Trump got this legal breakthrough, and he's hired Drew Findling, sometimes called the billion-dollar lawyer, as his counsel in Georgia. Now, Mr. Findling also, according to the New York Times, is best known for representing rappers. And bottom line, Trump is facing a potential RICO charge here, which is a gangster problem. And now he's tapped Gucci Mane's lawyer. It was Findling who got the very celebrated artist Gucci Mane off what could have been almost life and career-ending situations. He had 2013 charges that included allegedly threatening police, which has become quite popular among MAGA supporters lately. And Findling was able to bring that down from a possible 20 years in prison to 3. I'll tell you, in that situation, it was considered a legal success, although it is 3 more years in prison than his new client would be hoping to serve.
How about that? How about that? And here's the thing, that we're looking at all this stuff picked up at Mar-a-Lago months ago, 15 boxes, which they found secret, top secret, and confidential documents in, again, with his teeth and ring and a couple other things in the box. It seems like, oh, they would just put it. Listen, you can't tell me these things were put in these boxes with this other nonsense to give you the impression, well, they were just thrown together. Well, that's bullshit. That's bullshit. They aren't just thrown together. They were put in a box with a teaser ring and with a pen and a letter from Kim Jong-un to make you think, hey, there's nothing really in here. And here's the problem. Why is his dad, why are these top secret, secret and confidential papers in an area that someone can put them in a box? This information is supposed to be read only in a skiff or in the presidential office. Not even the White House. You don't take this stuff. You read it before the hell you get out of there. So, and we know he does not read. He can't read. That's one of the major problems why they didn't want to reveal any of his literacy that he had when he was in college. Because he probably failed. He was pushed out. They say he has a high IQ. Well, because you have a high IQ, that don't mean you're not stupid. Two different things. Well, we say he has a high IQ. Who say he has a high IQ? Of course, I don't know where he got that information from. We know that he gets very, very impatient and can't sit in front of anything that has a lot of information in it. He says, show me paperwork. Show me pictures. Well, I taught school. I taught a class, media literacy, which I created myself, which was accepted by the Southern Board of Education that goes around to check what you're doing in school and how the school is operating. In media literacy course that taught you how to critically hear, critically think, critically view. Because you can see all the intelligence you want, all the intelligence you want. If you don't know what you're looking at and you can't think about it, hey, you throw in the paperwork with the toilet paper. You throw that paperwork, secret paperwork, in with a letter from Kim Jong-un because you're just dumb. Now, that paperwork they got back there in February was signed by his lawyer. He said, oh, this is it. We don't have any other stuff here. I mean, don't these people know that when it's checked out of the skiff, or check out of wherever they keep it, there's a number attached to it, and the number of pages that are in that daggone secret or top secret compartmentalized documents. They know how many are in them. Compartmentalized documents. Don't mean it's just one document. Could mean it's 15 or 20. Could mean it's 50. Each one of those pages are marked. So if he thinks he can give us back 180 pages, and out of one document, and we know there's 300 pages in it, that shows you don't know how government works. He only operates what he used, how he worked when he was in his office. And that's why they're a single entity organization. He doesn't have a board. He doesn't have anything like that because he would have been fired a long time ago. That's why it's a family business, and it's run according to family business. I like my mayonnaise on the second shelf in the kitchen. I like my steak in the bottom of the freezer. Or I like my steak under S in the freezer because it's steak. But it's not tell you what kind of steak. Is it ribeye? Is it filet mignon? What kind of steak is it? This man does not know. Now, he could get away with that I just didn't know, but here's the problem. They have pictures of him and video of him going into the place where this information was kept. The Secret Service, whoever came there from the White House or from records said, look, get all this information and put it in one room under a new lock. They didn't say, okay, that room needs another lock. That's not the reason why it was put there. It was put in one room because he had it scattered all over. He put it in one room, he changed the lock. They didn't say, we're not coming back. We're going to come back and we're going to get this, provided if you don't give it to us. And remember, he kept saying, well, why didn't they just ask me? I would have given it to him. That's bullshit. They asked him about a half a dozen times. And he says, you already got it. That's why they had to do a subpoena with 30 or more agents going down there to get the information. They would not have done that with you or I or with the head of intelligence if he had secret papers kept in his vault in his house. They would have raided the place and took that shit out. I can't understand why they didn't do this months ago. Because they had to know what was missing from the archives. They had to know. So they had to be watching him. Now, what made us go now might be something on intercepts that he was going to give stuff away or arrange to have money given to a separate bank account because he's going to need a whole bunch of money to fight this stuff against the government. So, this man is completely a criminal. He acts like a criminal, and he talks like a criminal. He just steals top secret, and information. Let's see what Chris Hayes says.
Is, of course, a profound irony in Donald Trump's current legal predicament, which is, of course, that the intentional mishandling of classified documents, which Trump now stands accused of doing, is exactly what he said Hillary Clinton should be locked up for back in 2016. It was one of the core messages of his campaign, arguably the core message. According to Trump, Hillary Clinton could not be trusted because she maliciously and intentionally took extra legal steps to store highly classified documents on her private email server, which put our national security at risk. And to be clear, that was then and is now total nonsense. A State Department investigation under President Trump found that Clinton did not intentionally mishandle classified documents. Any transmission of classified information on Clinton's email was rare and accidental. Some emails were even classified retroactively after they were sent. And no prosecutor in their right mind would have brought a case against her for it. But that didn't matter. That didn't stop Donald Trump from attacking her for it constantly. And I've got to say, considering what we know now, what we've learned in the last few weeks about Donald Trump's willful, almost obsessive mishandling of some of our nation's most sensitive secrets, a lot of his attacks on Hillary have not aged well.
We can't have someone in the Oval Office
who doesn't understand the meaning of the word confidential or classified. This was not just extreme carelessness with classified material, which is still totally disqualifying. This is calculated, deliberate, premeditated misconduct, followed by a cover-up. In my administration, I'm going to enforce all laws concerning the protection of classified information. No one will be above the law.
I think everyone has like a fair amount of PTSD from the 2016 campaign and have blocked some of that out, but it can be difficult to remember in hindsight just how pervasive the attacks were. I mean, ubiquitous. First from right-wing media and then seeping into way more mainstream outlets. It was at the center of the campaign. Conservative media even made a cause celeb out of a Navy reservist named Brian Nishimura. Nishimura pleaded guilty to mishandling classified information and was sentenced to 2 years probation and a hefty fine back in 2015. The argument, so this talking point went, was that Nishimura got the treatment that Hillary Clinton deserved, even though it was, again, a total false equivalence. Unlike Clinton, Nishimura acted willfully and intentionally when he illegally downloaded classified documents from his base in Afghanistan and brought them back home. So again, despite being a manufacturer scandal, document retention habits became the issue of the 2016 campaign, the axis on which the world ended up turning. So much so that when Gallup created this word cloud or phrases that people spontaneously associate with the former Secretary of State, emails took up nearly the entire image, meaning it was by far the most frequent response, likely both because of the private server controversy and the hacking of DNC emails by the Russians, two scandals often conflated in the public consciousness. I think there's a pretty compelling argument that all this email nonsense cost Hillary Clinton the presidency. It was an effective attack. It fed into a lot of pre-existing attacks on Clinton the right had deployed and built up for decades. And clearly, the 11th hour announcement from then FBI Director James Comey that he was reopening the investigation into the emails just weeks before the election was, by all accounts, a major factor in her very, very narrow loss in the Electoral College. So then Trump became president, and while there was no justification to lock Clinton up, guess what? He did sign a law cracking down on the mishandling of classified information. Fun fact, Trump was actually reluctant to sign this bill to reauthorize FISA surveillance. And so perhaps to sweeten the pot, congressional Republicans added a provision into the bill to get him to sign it that made mishandling classified documents a felony, increased the penalty from 1 year in prison to 5. It might as well have been called the Hillary's Emails Act. Trump was serious about cracking down on leakers of classified information, like, for instance, whistleblower Reality Winner, who under Trump's DOJ was given the most severe sentence ever in the history of this country for leaking government material to the media. 63 months in prison for leaking a single classified document on Russian election interference on behalf of Trump's campaign. As David Lofman, Trump's DOJ counterintelligence chief, put it, quote, a great irony in Trump's attack on the FBI and DOJ over the court-authorized search of Mar-a-Lago is that during my tenure as chief of counterintelligence section, we were never under greater pressure to prosecute mishandling of classified information cases than we were under the Trump administration. Irony is right, right? If Donald Trump should be charged with intentionally mishandling these documents, a big if, granted, but if he is convicted, which again, an even bigger if, he could be sentenced under the law that he signed to score political points against an opponent who he falsely accused of doing the thing he actually did. The ancient Greeks truly could not script it better. The thing that seems most likely at this moment, as he faces legal peril in every direction he turns, the thing most likely to take down Donald Trump isn't the multiple allegations of sexual misconduct or the egregiously botched pandemic response, hundreds of thousands who needlessly died, or the deadly coup he launched at the Capitol on January 6th. It's the real-life version of butthurt emails.
Here's the problem. The president is down in Mar-a-Lago. He has Secret Service protection. Why does he have Secret Service protection? Because we give all the presidents that. But they're supposed to protect him, not paperwork. They wouldn't know a security document if it bit him in the ass. But yet someone down there knew where this stuff was and knew that Trump mishandled the classified documents and put human intelligence sources at risk, because that's what's missing here. We have human resources that are at risk in those documents, and we have other, they say, well, there's no nuclear. Baloney, we don't know that. There's top secret information. We don't know if that's included in nuclear. They decided not to say the word nuclear. So here's the problem. The ability to bypass the security at Trump's club demonstrates the ease at which someone could fake an ID and a shadowy background and go into Mar-a-Lago. A lock was a lock with a hasp on. You plug it in. Oh, it's a Yale lock. We can get past that. We don't have to break that. Combination lock, that's easy. This is complete nonsense. This is not how it's stored at the SCIF. This is not how it's stored at the archives with a hasp or a combination lock. That's not how it's done. So why did he think we still haven't got the answers? Why did he feel that these were his papers? I mean, if this was the paperwork when he had his crummy real estate broker, then I could say, yes, it's his. But this doesn't have his name on it. It doesn't have President number 45 on it. So we have a major problem here. A major problem. Now, I had some people ask me about what happened with the Ari Melber broadcast last week, because they weren't able to hear it all. And I wanted to play that again, and it's called The Rule of Law. And I'm going to play it right now so everybody can hear the whole thing. Ari Melber gives us the account of what the rule of law is. This is the best explanation of what has transpired since the orange man came into the White House until he's left, and then up to date till now. Please listen to this.
Turning to our special report right now on the rule of law and following the law, which Donald Trump refuses to do. The FBI searched Trump's Florida home because they said Trump was illegally holding top secret property and had violated lawful orders to return it. And a judge agreed. And then, as everyone now knows, that search unearthed some of that very property, which they said he was illegally holding and illegally refusing to provide back under subpoena. So that's bad for Trump. His actions, though, are separate legally from whether he intentionally committed a new felony there. It may turn out that, as far as the Justice Department's concerned, they subpoenaed the material, they view Trump's lawyers as violating the order around that, and that they went back into his house primarily to just get the material. And we know the Attorney General said they had already tried less intrusive means and then only went in because Trump was not compliant.
The department does not take such a decision lightly. Where possible, it is standard practice to seek less intrusive means.
That's true. And Garland was basically telling Trump in public that Trump brought the search on himself by all that time refusing to comply. He had well over a year to return the material in general. He had many weeks after it was subpoenaed. He didn't comply at all. That is striking because, remember, it is conservatives and many Trump allies who have been so quick to lecture you and Americans everywhere, whenever this has come up in the past, how if law enforcement asks you to do just about anything, then you have to go ahead and just comply.
Just comply, please. Listen.
I don't know why the gentleman did yield when he was asked to yield.
Those are Trump allies telling, in those cases, victims of police brutality, they should comply and yield. Why didn't you yield? And that's not any kind of just couple isolated examples. It is a standard piece of conservative refrains in these clashes over law enforcement and policing, including when people are documented as innocent or did nothing wrong or are facing very aggressive or even illegal police treatment. The line we hear over and over is just follow the officer's command and comply no matter what. If in fact a police officer gives you a command, please exit the car, you should say, yes, officer, no, officer, okay, officer.
I wish you would have complied a whole lot earlier.
Bad decisions by a cop, but those decisions wouldn't have been made if the perp didn't run away.
Just comply, please, listen.
Yeah, just comply. This frequent conservative claim goes well beyond complying with lawful police requests. I mean, listen to what we just heard. The demand is comply first, fully, no matter what. Yes, officer. Make any objections that may come up, presumably later. And this logic, this argument, this talking point has come from conservatives over and over. So I'm showing you some stuff that's on air, but this is in communities around America. Minnesota has a police union representative, Brian Peters, who in that Dante Wright case, who was killed by an officer mistakenly drawing a gun, said, well, still, they should have just complied. And he argued that it was the noncompliance that set off the chain of events that led to the death. Houston police has a union, and they had a similar take where they said, quote, comply, don't die, live to have your day in court. Those are real examples. And that includes times where police were later found to make mistakes or have, according to court, used excessive force, sometimes even on tape. But that loud, stubborn, and often smug lecture comes from national political elites on the right and MAGA leaders and Trump allies, all the way down to those police unions I mentioned. Comply. That's even when innocent people were injured or beaten or killed. That's a context here for the recent legal problems for Trump, because, again, this sometimes gets almost pushed out. There's so much going on, and that's why it's our special report right now, because I want everyone to understand Donald Trump was given months to comply, but he didn't. And Trump aides who've been given special, careful, elite treatment when asked to follow the law and testify have benefited from that whole different approach. There are Trump officials, though, who partially resisted, and there are others, especially for the January 6th committee, who fully resisted. No compliance. And I want to be clear. We're talking about Donald Trump and other powerful, well-connected white people who have acted like they are above the law, and their own past demands, some of which I just showed you, are really not about the rules. They're just telling others to comply. And many of those other cases involve regular citizens who don't have political connections and who are disproportionately black and brown people in America. So this is a documented double standard. Lawless resistance for these Trump elites, regimented compliance or violence for regular citizens, and especially regular citizens who are black and brown. And before I go any further, let's bring it together. We try to be clear here, and we try to be as factual and clear as possible. This is the same premise which animated all those Trump fans on January 6th. They genuinely expected to go in and break the law. They genuinely seemed to operate with immunity, to feel immune because of their privilege and worldview, and they brutally attacked police because they never cared about police or blue lives to begin with. Now, there are some people that day and the days after in America who were actually surprised by the Trump fans that day. Or some said, gosh, this is hypocritical given the past talk of blue lives. You know who wasn't shocked? All the MAGA people doing those crimes. Because that's what they came to do. And you know who else wasn't shocked? Their leader, who at the time was trying to lead a failed coup that was thwarted. Donald Trump was not shocked. He was elated, excited, juiced up. And he saluted them and called them special in real time. Because all those people together, who many of them hadn't met before, they already knew about this. If you were surprised or someone you know was surprised and someone you know was taking the blue livestock at face value. But it was crap. And they all knew it was crap because it was about power and dominance and race. And those people view the law as a way to enforce a right-wing white supremacy. And if they can't get the police to do that, which apparently they couldn't on the steps of the Capitol, but they have little use for it. And that's the deeper, more disturbing context for what we're living through right now, which I guess is surprising to some people. So let it not be surprising anymore. You have to see facts before you can fix facts. That's the disturbing context for this seemingly habitual political hypocrisy around the lawful search of Donald Trump's home.
The FBI raid of President Trump is a complete abuse and overreach of its authority.
The way our federal government has gone, it's like what we thought about the Gestapo.
This is absurd. Think about it. This has been a witch hunt for 6 years.
What they've been doing to President Trump is political persecution.
It is Joe Biden's DOJ, and they have weaponized this FBI at every turn.
If you're a Republican conservative and you hear the FBI is going after Trump again, it sounds alarm bells.
Alarm bells. Well, alarms are for emergencies. If there are alarms here, I can tell you the response to people connected to Trump who have not been complying has been at a very slow, careful, sensitive pace. Take two of Trump's former White House aides who refused to comply with lawful subpoenas, Bannon and Navarro. Well, they've had plenty of time. Bannon had weeks between refusing to comply and being held in contempt, another month until he was indicted in November. And even in a dispute over non-compliance, I want you to understand, legally, the Justice Department still arranged to give Mr. Bannon the opportunity to come in voluntarily, which he did. Now, Peter Navarro spoke openly about his efforts to overthrow the election, which brought legal scrutiny on him. He put out a book, he did interviews. Only after all that did Congress subpoena him in February. Then, when he did not comply, he was held in contempt in April and indicted months later in June. Now, after all that, unlike Bannon, the DOJ did not try, perhaps because they are not naive, they did not try to get him to come in voluntarily. Similar to the legal process for Trump, where you have to go to a judge, the DOJ determined Navarro was not legally trustworthy. That's not an opinion. There's actually a standard for that. So they asked the judge to approve what was the less intrusive approach. And that left Mr. Navarro outraged, rattled, and seemingly experiencing something that he did not think could happen to him.
Former advisor Peter Navarro is at this hour in federal custody. He was issued a subpoena in February to produce documents and appear before the committee in March, but refused to do either.
What did they do? They intercepted me getting on the plane. And then they put me in handcuffs, they bring me here, they put me in leg irons, they stick me in a cell. That's punitive. That what they did to me today violated the Constitution.
They did put him in handcuffs. Handcuffs are part of getting arrested, just like going into the cell before an arraignment. Now, Mr. Navarro then went on Fox News with those same complaints I just showed you, which is the same place where viewers had been lectured so many times on how to avoid exactly those problems with police. Just say yes, sir, yes, officer, and comply.
If, in fact, a police officer gives you a command, please exit the car, you should say yes, officer, no, officer, okay, officer.
That's not how Navarro sounded when dealing with law enforcement or the officers of the subpoena. Nor Bannon, nor Trump, who's going well beyond the Hannity standard of yes, officer, and currently threatening retaliation. But you could say, right, what's the context? What's the history? Those clips are from those reactions to police incidents with black Americans. So let's get into it. Some of what I showed you was the reaction to when an unarmed man, Walter Scott, was running away from an officer who shot him in the back and killed him. That was found to be illegal force because it was secretly caught on tape. Otherwise, we'd never know about it. Many critics still assailed Mr. Scott, seen there not posing a threat, for not complying. He's dead. Many times police use force even when people are seen complying. Terrence Crutcher had his hands clearly above his head, surrounded by officers and a cop car. When an officer still shot and killed him, that officer was acquitted. Now we're hearing talk about how agents searched Donald Trump's home under a warrant, or how they executed that arrest warrant for Mr. Navarro. Now remember, it was a no-knock warrant, which is not the least intrusive means, that was used in an operation that led to the police shooting a hospital EMT, Breonna Taylor, shooting her to death while she was asleep. That operation did not afford her a chance to comply. Or take a recent case involving Mr. Jacob Blake. Now, he had not complied with an arrest warrant, so that's what we could call Peter Navarro territory. But when police approached, he was not ever seen threatening or attacking. He was documented walking away, and that's when police shot him in the back 7 times, paralyzing him. A rush to use force in this disturbing scene. We are not showing the entire video under our standards and practices. Now, every example is not the same, but some of the commentators are. We just showed you Trump ally and lawyer Lindsey Graham, who actually recently blew through and did not comply with an ordered court appearance in Georgia. We'll see if he eventually shows up. Now, in this report, we showed him insinuating that a, quote, gentleman should have complied, should have yielded when asked. I just showed you Mr. Blake. That was Senator Graham talking specifically about Jacob Blake.
I don't know why the gentleman didn't yield when he was asked to yield.
He didn't yield when he was asked to yield, Mr. Graham says in response to the shooting. That's the wrong answer legally. Graham, a lawyer, knows it is illegal for police to use lethal force on a person simply because the person's fleeing. Resisting arrest is illegal, so is speeding, so is tax evasion. I could read you a lot of laws. Those things in America under the law and Supreme Court precedent are not punishable by a shooting or a summary execution. So the hypocrisy and the double standard here matters. It is political and it is racial. And the point is not that police should be using even more force against whomever suspects. The point is, today's right-wing politics and a very long strain of white supremacy in America views police as the muscle for that supremacist power structure. And it does not view police as stewards of independent fairness or accountability for all. It is a thuggish, authoritarian, and supremacist mentality. And it predates Trump, though he tapped into it and has helped animate it and make it worse. But that also means, according to what we know, it would likely endure well past the Trump era or any single politician. Now, they don't always teach this in school. So consider class in session here on the news tonight. Ibram Kendi has documented this wider history where many Americans may genuinely but mistakenly believe police violence is caused by just a lack of compliance rather than the violent remnants of slavery. And this is about facts and data, which show that American police escalate interactions on a racial basis. Police use more aggressive and less respectful approaches to black Americans in traffic stops, which are a very common first-order interaction between random people and police. And also, police use more respectful and de-escalating approaches with the majority of white Americans in the same stops. Data shows police sometimes even apologize for having to do the stop or the interaction at all, and that data overlaps with class discrimination. Yvonne Abraham writes in the Boston Globe that when you tie it together, for many conservatives, blue lives mattered only when they were policing black ones. So a lot of this is interrelated. And if it sounds hard to hear for some people who feel like they want to support police, or at least the honest police, or think better of America, I get it. I hear you. There's facts and emotion. The emotion you have for the officer down the block, or someone you had a good interaction with, or how you want America to be, that's understandable emotion. I get it. But I'm here reporting the facts for you. And the history of white supremacist violence and the way it relates to our current moment is a fact. So it's one that needs to be dealt with. There's more than one implication. For the lives of many real people, the less intrusive measures that were used in these examples to search Donald Trump or to peacefully arrest Steve Bannon, they can actually be deployed more often, more uniformly, and more fairly. And that's quite true, literally, as a matter of law and policing. If the innocent Breonna Taylor had been policed under the standard used for the guilty Steve Bannon, she would be alive today. And when I say guilty, I'm referring to his conviction, not an opinion. Just use the convicted Bannon standard, and she'd be alive. If the unarmed, no-threat Walter Scott had been later apprehended by the standard used for the indicted, not-complying Mr. Navarro, then Mr. Scott would be peacefully apprehended in handcuffs for a day in court, not shot in the back. The list goes on. And I can tell you, as a legal reporter and lawyer, it is a very long list. I'm not going to go through all of it tonight. This is about the type of policing which impacts the largest number of Americans. If you just made those changes, if you just afforded what I refer legally to as the convicted Bannon standard for those other people, many of them innocent, then another key implication goes to the empty core of this right-wing project. And that's the effort to control and corrupt any prospect of equal justice under the law in America. It is an effort to use or get law enforcement to be used as a tool of white supremacy and right-wing political persecution. Lock her up. But that campaign is bad for most Americans. It undermines public safety. It is undemocratic. And it is also very bad for honest police, because honest police officers don't want to be pulled into that political racial project. So when you hear a right-wing politicized framework about compliance, which you may when subjects turn and there's a debate about a different incident that doesn't involve them and their heroes, know that that framework is mostly crap and a trick, and that some of the people peddling it also know that, while others may just be repeating what they hear. The law requires compliance, but it does not mandate injury, let alone murder, to achieve compliance. And so it may seem sometimes like everything runs together, and we live in a mediated environment where you can link almost anything. But these are not links we're drawing in observation. These are the roots of the justice system. And for people who care about justice and want the system to better pursue it, these are pieces of history, of violence, of state murder that we have been working on for a very long time. And if you think it feels hopeless, you have to remember, the reason that so many people lie about the justice system is that even they in their cynicism know the truth can still matter. They seem to think if enough people knew the truth, maybe their efforts wouldn't work as well, so they keep lying to you. Don't let them get away with it. Keep your eye on the ball and on these facts, because justice is still possible. We'll be right back.
Thank you, Ari.
Okay. As usual, I forgot to turn on the speaker. Now, what Ari just gave you was the most definitive explanation of what the hell is going on. If this orange man who used to be in the White House was an ordinary citizen, his ass would have been in jail, because he's here in this country. Why do you think that young man ran to Russia? There's no deportation from Russia. There are a few countries out there, but this is where Trump needs to go, because he is going to jail. I didn't believe that before. There's a major problem here that we have with this clown. And I used to say clown prince. He's not a clown prince. He's a clown. And what do we do in this situation? What do we do in this situation when you got someone like this? Here's another piece where Ari said. This is part two where Ari just said that he said Trump needs a lawyer.
Now to our special report. A former president's struggle to get just about any criminal defense attorney is while he's facing basically the most escalating simultaneous criminal probes of his long litigious life. The new headline this week is familiar. Everyone at law firms saying no to Trump's bids to get seasoned lawyers. It's familiar because you may recall it's a problem Trump also faced, and this was documented during the Mueller probe. Now, the reporting states the reasons stem from, one, Trump is a person, and two, Trump is a deadbeat. His style and refusal to cooperate or take advice makes him nearly impossible to represent, say sources. One observer diplomatically noted it would be unclear if new lawyers would ever get paid. Yes, it would be unclear. Or there's a long line of litigation and complaints about him not paying bills. So Trump has been in similar spots before. And he has found lawyers, and he has evaded other cases. So let's be clear. You might hear this and say, okay, Ari, but we've heard about this before, and then he still got away. But I want to be clear with you, only following the facts as we can find them, Donald Trump is in a measurably worse and more desperate legal condition now. For example, before, he'd never been subject to a criminal search of his home. That's a first this month. He'd never pled the Fifth Amendment until last week. He has a federal criminal probe eyeing his failed coup, which is a set of government-related problems with people cooperating when he's out of government, so different than the Mueller probe. And then just today, as reported, the top finance officer of his company pleading guilty. The whole firm awaits that October trial. And one of Trump's recent lawyers, who's not available to represent him anymore, is because of his legal problems. Rudy Giuliani, busy with the criminal probe in Georgia, where he has been formally targeted for indictment, just testified 6 hours yesterday. And that's a trend with Trump's lawyers. They often find themselves in need of other lawyers. And that's the third reason that sometimes it can be hard for him to find lawyers, because the new lawyers look at this kind of case, understand not only could it be expensive when they don't get paid, but it could be disastrous if they lose their law license, like Roy Cohn, who was disbarred, or Michael Cohen, who was convicted, or the recently searched coup lawyer, John Eastman. Now, Trump's lawyer representing specifically the Florida matter, that search, is already linked to the elector fraud plot, which means she could have Giuliani-type problems, and she left television to work for Trump, but then likened the situation, well, back to the silver screen. Why wouldn't you just release that yourselves?
Well, this is part of the discussion with the Department of Justice. Of course, we're trying to do everything in accordance with the law and
there's absolutely nothing preventing you guys from releasing it, though.
Other than decorum.
That's one relatively new lawyer in Florida where, as we reported, there are signs that the search was more about recovering evidence than preparing charges, meaning that is not Donald Trump's worst problem. Most people would be very concerned to have their home searched under a criminal warrant in any situation, but for him, Florida's lesser. So what's more? Well, as I'm telling you, it's a different story in Georgia where the DA has targeted over a dozen people for indictment for alleged crimes that were to benefit Trump, meaning not just random crimes or people he knows, but crimes for his political benefit, for his attempted coup. And it's linked to his own illicit demands, which were caught on tape.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have.
That is very bad. That is now criminal evidence. That is on tape. If you follow this stuff sometimes and you say, gosh, it seems like Trump did so much all over the place, especially around trying to overthrow the election, that's public evidence. That's something people can decide whether it disqualifies him for office or not in your own mind and vote. But our legal system, as I've told you, is much more precise. So if he does one thing over here in Wisconsin and another in Georgia, those are two different state probes and dealing with state law. Georgia is the place that's the worst for Trump. Georgia is the place where you have that tape. Georgia is the place where you have others already marked for targeted indictment. Now, having said that, nobody can predict what DAs or grand juries will do. But the evidence matters, so you have more damning evidence in Georgia than any other state. So his problem is most acute there. And let me tell you something. Donald Trump seems to know that. Because while I just showed you the reporting about how he's juggling this search for lawyers in more than one case all over the country and in his home state of Florida and recruiting people off TV or off personal relationships, in Georgia it's a little different, which is our special report. New information, he has now turned to a seasoned criminal defense trial lawyer who has actually clashed with this same DA in Atlanta, who has won some uphill criminal cases, who is part of a small but experienced criminal defense firm. It's the Findling Law Firm in Georgia, and it's headed by the former president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We're talking about real credentials here. The New York Times just broke the news that Trump got this legal breakthrough, and he's hired Drew Findling, sometimes called the billion-dollar lawyer, as his counsel in Georgia. Now, Mr. Findling also, according to the New York Times, is best known for representing rappers. And bottom line, Trump is facing a potential RICO charge here, which is a gangster problem. And now he tapped Gucci Mane's lawyer. It was Findling who got the very celebrated artist Gucci Mane off what could have been almost life and career-ending situations. He had 2013 charges that included allegedly threatening police, which has become quite popular among MAGA supporters lately. And Findling was able to bring that down from a possible 20 years in prison to 3. I'll tell you, in that situation, it was considered a legal success, although it is 3 more years in prison than his new client would be hoping to serve.
There are 3 problems with the criminal justice system: racism, mass incarceration, and the issue of collateral consequences. Did that judge stop the hearing to basically say, hey, check out the black woman, she's articulate?
I think is that we've exaggerated what gangs are in Atlanta. I think we've exaggerated what RICO is in Atlanta. We're not really indicting anybody for Quentin Tarantino films, are we?
Right. Mr. Feng there, speaking about a case we've covered that is involving the same DA and the use of evidence against artists. What we have here is a real-life story of rap and law combining. It's also an important legal development for this Georgia case. Now, yes, I'll be honest with you. It might be tempting to take this opening to try to wedge in some Gucci Mane reference into Trump's situation, but that doesn't seem necessary right now. And honestly, that's not what we're about here. It's not like just because the former president and Gucci Mane are in a story, we're going to just squeeze in every last Gucci bar into a newscast. I mean, does that sound like something we would do? Trump often talks like he's tough. Like he's ready for these legal fights, like, to use the common parlance, he wants the smoke. Sometimes he makes it sound like he wants all the smoke. But in many of these big cases, Trump University, testifying to Mueller, firing his own staff, Donald Trump don't want the smoke. To paraphrase Gucci Mane, why you flexing, Donald? You don't want no smoke. You don't want no smoke. That was then. Now there is plenty of smoke for Donald Trump in Georgia. And to be clear, Findling is a serious attorney. He is known sometimes by certain cases, including representing some of Georgia's most prominent artists. But we've actually had him on the beat before as a prominent criminal defense attorney for his legal expertise assessing then-Trump lawyer Alan Dershowitz.
Now, I look at it as a trial attorney, and I look at Alan Dershowitz speaking and think about how he would be cross-examined. And he ended by talking about how partisan the proceedings have been to date. That shows that he's walking into this with a political opinion.
That's what he told us right here on the beat. Now, today, Findling is not analyzing Trump lawyers. He is one. And as a longtime civil rights advocate, he's also been publicly critical of Donald Trump. He called him a, quote, racist, and labeled him pathetic once again. So there is a lot here apart from the rap overlap. And we are learning that whatever else you think here is going on, Donald Trump or someone close to him who can affect his decision making knows the difference between the search in Florida and the potential indictment in Georgia, knows the difference between some of what's going on in New York, which is serious but may not reach him personally, and what apparently requires one of the type of, and they say this as a compliment in the bar, one of the type of legal killers you need to deal with real cases and real prison time against that DA and that use of RICO in Atlanta. So that's pretty striking. Now, ultimately, only Trump knows if this particular lawyer will get the bag, and if a counsel who once called Donald Trump racist is a fake friend or a true dog, or is someone who might only be after a publicity stunt. Either way, we know Trump is back at it again because he's faced legal pressure before. The big question here is, will he end up legally both eyes closed? Now, are these serious questions, or are these all Gucci Mane songs? Only time will tell.
I want everybody to have a great weekend. All right, Melba, going off with us, but we're going to go off with what some of these people, these pathetic people out there, as Hillary Clinton called them, are they still going to live him tomorrow? I don't know.